when you go into mythology, when you go into the Star People tales, when you go into the Anunnaki, it is the sameness, the similarity around the planet that makes you say something has to be responsible for the same dreams, the same mythology, the same idea that life came from the stars.
All across the world, we find stories of otherworldly or extraterrestrial beings coming to Earth and influencing humanity. This raises a question. Are there different races of beings coming from the stars and influencing all these cultures? Or is it possible that in fact it's one race of beings, the Anunnaki, who influenced all of these cultures and they told the story of the same beings?
Mesopotamia means between rivers in Greek, referring to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is today known as Iraq. There were four main kingdoms in Mesopotamia. Sumer was the oldest one, followed by the kingdom of Akkad, begun by Sargon I. After that, you have Babylonia and Assyria. And even though languages changed and people changed to some degree, the culture that was established by the Sumerians really continued throughout the lifetime of Mesopotamia.
Ancient Sumeria in southern Mesopotamia is often cited as the most ancient civilization, even the first civilization. It goes back to approximately 3,000 to 4,000 BC, and here we see writing in the form of cuneiform tablets on clay and on stone.
The Sumerians were the ones who invented the cuneiform writing system. The word cuneiform means wedge-shaped. It refers to a system of writing whereby scribes would take a wedge-shaped stylus and impress signs on wet clay tablets. Those tablets could later be fired and hardened and preserve what was ever written on them.
Deciphering these cuneiform tablets was next to impossible until a key discovery of thousands of tablets at an Assyrian palace in March of 1843. This new abundance of cuneiform inscriptions provided some of the first tangible evidence of an ancient kingdom that had been believed to exist thousands of years ago.
A French scientist named Paul-Émile Botta found this gigantic underground area in northern Iraq in Khorsabad, opened up this incredible room filled with statues of gods and kings, all kinds of wonderful treasures, and many written inscriptions all over the walls in the ancient Sumerian cuneiform.
Within 10 years, archaeologists had also discovered the ruins of the legendary Sumerian capital city of Ur, home of the biblical figure Abraham. At the site, scientists unearthed the great ziggurat of Ur, a step pyramid-shaped structure that was the administrative center of the city, as well as cuneiform tablets and tombs adorned in gold.
So here they had found this legendary capital of the Sumerians with its gold-clad tombs and cuneiform tablets, something that they thought was simply a myth until the actual discovery of it proving that it was indeed historical fact.
This is the Black Incuridian Transmission.
I need more bass. I'm nasally. I have allergies, so.
You want more bass? So I can put the bass up.
I'll talk low. I'll do my Barry White voice.
All right, so. No. Yeah, I got it basically. I got us kind of rigged up here how we do. And we're doing our level best to just kind of bring the discussion forward. And, it, you know, you, we usually, like, all of our discussions are encrypted and deeply private. We only have secret and occult discussions around here. But so every once in a while, our discussions get interesting enough where we bring them to the surface a little bit. And this particular topic is fascinating. So it's hard to really kind of give it a specific name. Like, giving this episode like a really effective title is going to be difficult because you're talking about prehistory, right? Prehistory is not easy to touch on in any media, whether it's video. We could have little charts. We could try to do a video diagrams, but the whole subject matter is really engrossing and massive.
It really is. In lieu of the fact that the Sumerians recorded everything on their cylinder scrolls,
the tablets,
and yeah. But the way they did it, the scrolls are cylinder.
Aren't those dies where they can make these like regular
absolutely
messages? Yeah, they're pumping these things
yeah
out.
So yeah, close, you roll yeah them out. Absolutely. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I saw you were on the right track. There are so many podcasts on the Anunnaki. And I want to stay away. A lot of them are New Agey, and I'd like to stay away from that and maybe lay down a general history with some, I guess, caveats. But the general history of what Zachariah Sitchin revealed in the 12th Planet about the Anunnaki, and not go too much into whether we subscribe to it or not, but maybe talk about how it dovetails into the Bible story.
Right, right. That's what I was going to go to, is I just in order to kind of bring it down to earth. Are we really talking about the Nephilim? Isn't it really just another way? That's how I look at the Babylon story when you have the...
Okay, well, what we'll do is I'll say a little bit about that, and then maybe lay down a general history of the Anunnaki, what the scrolls reveal. Not everyone agreed with Zachariah Sitchin. Not a lot of people have his knowledge of ancient languages. There are some people who refute him. Okay, so let's just talk about the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki, as the story goes, there's this 12th planet. And the reason it's 12 is because I believe the moon, they counted the moon as a planet and the sun as a planet, I think. And possibly another object. But here's the story. There's a planet called Nibiru. And this is from the Anunnaki, from the Sumerian scrolls. And Nibiru apparently is this planet that has a 6,000-year revolution around the sun. And they're called shars. Each revolution is called a shar.
So their one-year circular revolution is a comparison to 6,000 of ours. Just so we can have
absolutely
some
right. Okay. And there's the prevailing theory, which I do not subscribe to, is that, well, I subscribe to this part. They when Nibiru gets close to Earth, they send out ships to come to the planet, which some ships are already here, supposedly. And the reason they came here, according to Zachariah Sitchin, this is what I don't subscribe to, but it's interesting. Apparently, they had a problem with their atmosphere, and I believe they were getting too many rays from the sun or too many cosmic rays, and they use gold and monatomic gold to put into their atmosphere to stabilize it. And they found a treasure of gold on Earth, and they began 400,000 years ago mining the Earth for gold. With their people, there's gold mines in South Africa that date back 4,000 years.
Yeah, there.
Nobody knows.
There's biblical references to these like massive stores of gold that are so they're in the desert areas and certain. I have to go back and look at the gold of Ophir. If you go look, it's so plentiful that it was found right like laying on the ground like rocks, you know, all over the place. So.
Yeah, well, no, you got to differentiate. There's gold and there's monatomic gold. And monatomic gold as far as I've seen, is a white powder, but it has the properties of gold, the conductivity, the valence electrons. So and, this, I mean, gold
is it rarer than the kind of yellow, the metal gold?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
It is. But what happened, getting back to the Anunnaki, is, as the story goes, 400,000 years ago, they began operations on Earth. After 200,000 years of doing that, there was an uprising among the Anunnaki. They were sick of working on Earth. They were tired of it. They wanted to go back. They wanted to do their own thing. They wanted to be their own gods a little bit, because they were looked at as gods, apparently. So they...
No, we were on monatomic gold, yeah.
So what they did, there was an uprising, and the Anunnaki took a primate. I'm not sure which primate, but they took a primate that was close to human. And this gets into the Nephilim in Genesis 6:4.
Okay. So this is human origin story. You're going on a human origin story right now.
Absolutely, okay. Yes. So they said, and think about the Bible. They said, let us put our essence into this primate and make him do the work for us. Now think about that. The Bible says, the Elohim said, let us make man in our image. So there's something there to that.
Humanity is faced with the question of the open mystery of its own beginning place in history, because we definitely don't belong to the evolutionary chain of events here on Earth. If we look around and we look at the rabbits and we look at all the normal, the elephants, and we do not fit here. We're not part of what this whole place is, right? We're part of the chain of life, undoubtedly so, but we definitely are not a part of Earth's natural history, right? So the question to kind of paper it over was always the Darwinian, you know, evolutionary lens kind of way of just explaining away. You know, of course, we are life forms and we're biological, but the mystery of human existence and the question mark of our specific heredity and our specific unique characteristics in our biology is not explained by Darwin. And it's not explained necessarily by the Bible either.
Right. And there's two things we can talk about.
But the point is that I think that you can look at the Bible and you can read the stories and you can find, you know, the question of human existence addressed. But there's a lot of big open gaps. There's a lot of huge questions. You know what I mean? It gives the beautiful story about the Garden of Eden. But at the same time, there's you know, people will excuse that as an allegory, as symbolism, as not really, maybe as mythology. And so it doesn't give us a real sense of what is really happened there, you know. But we do have the clues about the Nephilim, but only very brief little occultic and cryptic. We have to go and in this particular episode or this feature that we're bringing out here, we have to really address the Book of Enoch too, because there's no way to get around it.
Yeah, the Book of Enoch, Genesis 6:4 and a couple of other passages in the Bible reference it, the Book of Enoch.
Right.
I have a friend that I talk to who is totally against it. She says it's not canon.
No, it's not.
And she's Seventh-day Adventist. And if it's,
yeah, but
if
I
it's
can't,
not canon,
I, yeah.
Who compiled the canon?
Well, you go back to the Nicene 39 or something. They were trying to decide what was really, really from the disciples and from the apostles and what was interesting but secondary, and it was apocryphal. And so I won't excuse it, I won't dismiss it entirely. I understand it's not part of the record of the 66 books of the Bible that we understand. But at the same time, all those 66 books in the Bible, I think at that time in the Nicene Council, they were pretty serious scholars at that point in time. And they were still being serious about their business, despite, you know, how the papacy was rising and et cetera. But I still think that those particular books, and I think that God has the power to keep his word together despite whoever the men were, you know. So, but I still have to look at the Book of Enoch, and I have to say, look, this is serious information. This is a serious business right here, and see what it says. And it applies to what we're discussing.
It really does. I wanted to get back to the Anunnaki on something.
Yeah, no, take your time, because like I said, this, we have to kind of do this introduction, because the whole subject matter is just all over the place, and it goes back, like you said, maybe 40,000 years. And at first, I was
400,000.
Right. Okay. But I mean, at first, I was one of those individuals who was kind of constrained by the typical biblical understanding. But I think that it becomes too narrow, and maybe there are these other legacies of history have a lot to offer. Let's say.
Yes, definitely. I love the Bible. I love the Bible, but I do not believe that the canon is all that we have is all that is there. The Book of Enoch, it's interesting.
It definitely doesn't include whatever was burned in the libraries of Alexandria, because that's gone. So, I mean, there is more, right?
Yeah, I still get pissed off about that, the burning of it. It was three burnings of Alexandria. I mean, as the story goes, the Anunnaki set up earthly kings, pharaohs and whoever else. They set up earthly kings, and they gave knowledge about existence to the priesthoods and secret societies. They set them up because they wanted us to know. But because that knowledge is power, these secret societies have kept it from us. And I believe the Catholic Church the papacy is a secret society. I mean, can you imagine if we had like a month where you and I could just invade the library at the Vatican?
No, I recently had this thought. No kidding. I recently had this exact thought where I was thinking there's so many holes here that if you could go down there and like get through there and look at it, you know, maybe get it interpreted. You have all this AI now, you know, we could get it really like broke down quickly, you know. So, but yeah, there's
actually, you're right. We could ask AI to lay it all out for us and then just regurgitate it. Really.
Yeah, we could snap pictures. We could snap pictures with our phone and just get it interpreted with AI. It doesn't have any reason to lie to us. I mean,
civilization is much older, much older. The archaeology hides it from us. Graham Hancock, as you know, has a hard on for archaeologists because they're so closed-minded.
So thank you for joining Black Ink Caribbean podcast, and we just have to take a moment to thank our wonderful sponsor, and that is St. John's Flower Market, guys. St. John's Flower Market, right there in Jacksonville, Florida. And of course, you can send all kinds of beautiful bouquets and flower displays all over the America and even the world, I imagine, in certain locations, right? So please take advantage of St. John's Flower Market, and you can go see all their lovely displays and all the beautiful arrangements that they have, and you can definitely send beauty, right? You can send beauty to your loved ones and all kinds of various occasions and weddings and events, and you can go see St. John's Flower Market, St. John's Flower Market at stjohnsflowermarket.com, St. John's Flower Market. Of course, that's an abbreviation for St. John's Flower Market. And St. John's is a huge area in Jacksonville, Florida, and of course, it's local to us here in Florida. It's a wonderful dear friend, so please take time to go and visit St. John's Flower Market, stjohnsflowermarket.com. Wonderful displays, and you can follow them on Instagram. You can send a gift of love to your loved ones on all kinds of holidays and various occasions. You can send sympathy and reach out to people who may not be doing well, and you can send them a bouquet of wellness and beauty right to their front door, guys. So St. John's Flower Market, established in 1993, stjohnsflowermarket.com.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. I think that it's happening, this explosion of knowledge is really developing online, because as we begin to see the images, before you had to go there and maybe you could get a drawing or you could get a description in a book, but you couldn't take the full, you know, the full magnitude of what, in the totality of what is going on there. And this is happening all over the world. And as they begin to get more and more refined in their dating, and the scholarship is always going to excel by those who are innovative and want to break through the next wall, right? It's how it is in science and every level. Like, the next individuals who are able to break through the kind of wall of ignorance and get to the next level of knowledge wins, right? So you're always going to have these guys bringing this information out and drawing the story out more. And I think that, yeah, there's a lot there. Just like how every day there's like a new fish in the ocean that no one's ever seen before, and I can see it on Facebook, right? This is the same thing.
Yeah, like the coelacanth is one of them.
Absolutely, yeah. I think the same thing is happening when you see archaeologically across the world. You can see that there's new, you know, ability to find these cities. Like, what's the one particular city you were talking about? Let's go into that a little bit. So it was found, and it was already stacked full of stones. Was that? Do you figure that was done carefully?
It's Göbekli Tepe. It's in Turkey. It was a city. It had megalithic structures. It had on the megaliths. It had this art that it wasn't embossed inside, but it was convex art on the stones, which means they had to carve the stones around the pictures that they wanted. They're animals that should have been extinct at the time, but they weren't. It dates back to 11,000 years. That puts it just after the younger Dryas period, which is a period. It has to do with a flower called the Dryas and the younger Dryas. But what happened is there was, let me say something else about Göbekli Tepe before I go ahead.
Absolutely.
Göbekli Tepe was built, it was used for at least 1,000 years. Then it was buried, literally buried with rocks and dirt and whatever. And it was so well preserved. And at that time, humans were only hunter-gatherers, considered as mainstream archaeologists tells us.
Well,
they could never have built that.
Right. Also, and this is at a certain stage in history. And if you go back, archaeology only is able to explain history to a certain extent. And now we're finding this new historical link in all these structures and this new exposure of history, so that you can see that there, even at the time when at that point in history when man was only hunter-gatherer, that was just the present state of a man at that time. But if you could rewind the tape back far enough, we're going to discover that there was an ancient civilization, a prehistoric civilization that was with advanced technology. Is that what we're getting to? We're getting to the...
Very, very advanced.
Very advanced. Inexplicably advanced, right? So that's what this is. This is what this story is leading us to.
And the Hindus, with their yugas, they have these epochs of time called yugas. That dovetails into this story, too, because the yugas explain mankind as far as technology and enlightenment is concerned. Right now, it's thought we're in the Kali Yuga, the final one, before the yuga cycle starts over again.
That's fascinating. So that's lining up with the Hindu tradition, and it has to do with the Mayan record, too, which I'm not able to read it. But people were saying that, you know, it was dating to these certain periods of epics, you know, epics of time. And then we're getting to this closing point.
They contend that mankind has had many golden ages over the past couple of 100,000 years. And who knows what technology they were using. Something I want to get into is the Sphinx. There's proof now that the Sphinx is at least 11,000 years old, 15,000 years old, possibly 30,000 years old, for two reasons. One reason is the weathering on the Sphinx shows great water weathering, and there hasn't been rain significant enough to cause that weathering in 10,000 years. There's another, what's the other story about the Sphinx?
I wanted to kick in here, and we did a little brief discussion on this once, maybe for 15 minutes, but we were discussing Baalbek, which is between Lebanon and I don't want to get it wrong, but
oh my God.
Yeah, so Baalbek.
That's so incredible.
Yeah,
so incredible.
Hit it. Yeah, go ahead.
The stones are so many hundreds of tons. I mean, you've seen them. What were they for? I mean, what were they for? We don't know. Was it a wall? People think it was part of a landing field.
They have these stones, these monstrous stones, and they're laid in place. And then they have this one particular stone that it obviously never got in position, but it's just and it's kind of laid in stuck out of the mud or out of the dirt, and it's obviously like,
yeah, in the quarry.
It's bigger.
There's
than
some in the quarry.
Yeah, it's bigger than a large building, and it's just a complete total stone. And they obviously were And you can see that it's totally beyond human capability of any, unless we had we have no cranes today, we have no loaders, we have no steel making ability or hydraulics that could actually could possibly move it. You know what I mean? So it's an incredible mystery.
And these things come from so far away. Pyramid stones, just those stones, they come from up to 500 miles away. They were transported. How the hell were they transported? There's a theory that the sound might have been used, because sound modulated at certain frequencies can produce anti-gravity effects.
Yeah, if you can use sound modulation and frequencies to like pick up a little dice, like a little small dice toy, and spin it around in the air, you could do the same thing to a large stone.
Yeah, by extension, you could do anything, right, depending if you have it. And if another thing that's interesting, and we're jumping around a little bit, but there are several carvings and paintings, Egyptian paintings, of these gigantic light bulbs cooked to something. Okay, that's one thing. And then you have the batteries found in Iraq that are over 2,000 years old, batteries that some still hold a charge. So I don't think that was cutting-edge technology for them. I think those were hand-me-downs from previous times.
Right.
That secret knowledge, like we talked about.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's true. It goes, if you look at the Pythagoreans, if you go to the Greeks, they were not like just dealing with trivial, you know, playtime stuff. They were interested in conducting and transmitting a deeply meaningful and highly complex scientific mathematics and scientific knowledge, you know, and they were doing it in a way that was the most deepest degrees of secret initiation possible, so that it could not be abused, or it could not be possibly used as weapons against, you know, you can imagine, right? It's like anything. It's highly sensitive.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I think that many times secret societies were formed to operate in times when if you were heretical, if you were against the common orthodoxy, you know, any kind of way, if you were in Muslim lands or if you were in Christendom, you know, you were likely to be suspicious. You were likely to be suspected of not, you know, not being able to chant the entire prayer or say the entire oath, or, you know, say the complete Muslim dogma that they might ask you to say. Right. And so
they have to learn the Quran. They learn the Quran. They can literally
say the verses,
regurgitate, right, the Quran. Yeah. Let's talk about something else that fits in. I want to talk about Vimanas and Hindus and the Mahabharata. These Vimanas are spaceships. They're and flying machines on Earth, but they don't just talk about them. They give detailed explanations of how they work. And one of the ways they work and achieve anti-gravity is, they use counter-rotating, and this was in the Mahabharata, they use counter-rotating electric fields, magnetic fields, in Mercury. And they say Mercury. And it has now been proven that when you rotate Mercury through electronic fields, you create anti-gravity.
Well, Mercury is a very interesting element on the atomic chart, but it also is a very interesting figure in occult history. And occult knowledge too, at one time, right? So when you say, yes, Mercury, you're also speaking about,
well, with Mercury, they call it Quicksilver, right, which kind of has an exciting name. But the Hindus apparently are, as far as I know, the Hindus, we're looking back 8,000 years, 7,000 years. Of writing and oral tradition.
I wanted to say Hermes Trismegistus, because he was because that was another figure of like Nike, who was the messenger of the gods, right? Who is this particular figure of like Quicksilver or Mercury, who was a particular individual? But go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt.
We can bounce around for a while, but the Hindus it's very compelling. And then you have places in, you help me here, it's the Chinese desert. It's a big desert in China.
Gobi Desert.
Okay. I was thinking Göbekli Tepe, and I couldn't think of the Gobi Desert, where they found, not all over the place, but in many places, they found molten glass. They found high radioactivity in different places compared to adjacent places. And the Mahabharata talks about a war that they had where these weapons were so destructive. And one of the things the people had to do if they were exposed to the weapons was go into the water and bathe and scrub themselves, which is what you would do for radioactivity.
Right.
Not if an event, I don't think an advanced race would necessarily use the atomic bomb. I think there's a lot more.
Well, when you're talking about atomic ways. Yeah, you're talking about atomic bombs. You're finding ways to exploit the energy that is released when you split atoms. So, you know, that's pretty elementary. There might be a lot more that could be done there. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, think of the CERN supercollider.
Right. Exactly.
They send these electromagnetic and other radioactive waves around, I believe it's 27 miles. And they do it a few times, and it gets close to the speed of light, and then they smash them into a wall of some kind. And when they do, the constituent particles come out, and they are finding all of these other particles, like the Higgs boson, the God particle. They found gluons, which are elementary particles that help hold matter together. They found so many things there.
Tachyons,
yeah.
Which apparently they can just pass through matter.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this, because we have to talk about so many, and we wanted to really bring in to the issue of the age of the Earth, too, and the age of the universe, because I think we're coming out of this period, even in the 1800s and 1900s, where people didn't know how to address the issue of the creation of the Earth and the kind of biblical record and understanding about it. And now it's being translated through Greek into English to us. But if you go back and do the study, you can find that if you look at Genesis carefully, it discusses these large scale production periods of the universe's production into existence, you know, through these periods of creation that I think people were myopically trying to constrain it to 24-hour periods of like maybe 24 hours. And like you think about 24 hours on Nibiru, right? And Planet X, right? And so do you think that when Planet X comes through, it was expected to be highly destructive? Is that the kind of the concept there?
Yeah, there have been people who have tied many of the global catastrophes to Planet X. The idea is that it's the gravity that when it doesn't always come the right distance from Earth to affect it, but the gravity has terrible effects on the Earth, earthquakes, floods, and such.
Right.
If you, it's interesting, speaking of floods, the Epic of Gilgamesh, I recently just went through a series on that.
Yep.
And Gilgamesh is a part Anunnaki, part human. He meets up with a guy named Imnapishtu, and he is collecting animals for an ark. So it's thought that he is the origin of the Noah story. And what happens is Gilgamesh is told by the Anunnaki that the earth is going to be flooded. I don't know why. It could be any number of geological or celestial reasons. But the earth was flooded. So
right.
I don't know what it was, but it happened. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, the biblical record has got to have that as the foundational point, where that's the origin story for the biblical record is this latest kind of modern contemporary destruction of Earth. That was the Noah story, right? So that flood story is a most recent kind of reset, if you want, of Earth history, with such a massive destruction that it reset some of this ancient civilization that we see that we can find all over. You can go to Peru I mean, you and me were discussing trying to plan maybe some trips down there to look at the stonework.
Oh, God, I'd love it.
Right. You know, and it doesn't seem like it's totally out of reach, but yeah, I think I want to see it in person too. And I think that we're seeing more and more pictures, more and more video, and better scale science that shows that it's more inexplicable than ever, right? You know, I think before they thought they had some kind of handle on how you could go 10,000 feet up into the mountains and create such, you know, today, even in today's measure, there's no way to comprehend how we could even do it, right?
And we talked about this before too. There's the theory that the complex there in Peru.
Oh, is it? Are we talking about
Machu Picchu?
Machu Picchu. Okay, so we're discussing Machu Picchu. Yeah, that's just nearby. I mean, and that's close to.
Yeah, if you look at the construction of the temples and the other buildings there, the stones are in such a way that not even a sliver of paper will fit between them. And it's theorized that somehow they melted that stone and formed it into place, which is interesting because that stone takes, I believe, the stone they use in order to get into a molten state, it requires about a 5,000 degree temperature. But it's a really good explanation because these stones, you'd have to look at them. We need to put some examples in the link.
Yeah, so the stones were poured by, the granite was poured by, into forms by, as a molten state, a liquid state, and then cooled. I mean, it is such a bizarre explanation, but it's hard to really explain how else it could be done like that. You know what I mean?
Because, I mean, who's to say, I mean, technology goes, a lot of technology, the evolution of it is accidental. And I wonder, I mean, I think that technology could have, in the ancient past, technology could have, it could have been totally different, completely different, but yet still just as advanced.
Yeah, I have a sneaking suspicion that there's all these other combinations of structures and molecules and atomic elements and undiscovered features of the ecosystem all around us that we just cannot find a way to extrapolate from. And there was a few times in history where there were especially brilliant men or people who had ancient knowledge or who could put the pieces together and develop technology, these advances. But I think that there's much more that around us that was obviously being used in the ancient past. And so we're going, it's like antediluvian history. We're trying to reach back in time before the flood, before the flood epic, before when Noah lived, right? The time when Noah lived, and he even had the ability to even build such a massive ark. It's such a bizarre thing. It said in his time that the people in the cities, there were big cities, and they made fun of him because he was remote and he was a weirdo and he was building a crazy ark, right? He was the crazy ark guy, right? So this is a day when, if you look at the history and the geology of it, this is when the Bible calls a day before clouds, a day before men really understood rain even. You know what I mean? I think that it was a different time. He said it was a time when, if you look at the history carefully in Genesis, when the dew of the ground came up and watered the earth. And so, you know, we're in a period now where it's called a day of clouds. But I think that if you go back, there are kind of esoteric teachers that will show that there was an upper chamber of water in the high atmosphere that was crystallized above the earth, right?
And they call it a canopy.
Right. Exactly. So you know about that. And I think that these were oceans above. How we have oceans below. There was once these high oceans up above.
The fountains of the deep.
Right. And there was...
So the fountains of the deep and the canopy of water from the top came down.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly right.
So...
I think that was something that was probably unexpected at the time. People talk about how that could have been shattered or how it could have been... You know, what could have made that take place where that condensation, that final breakdown of Earth's structure took place. And so we have all these torrents of water here on Earth where you can see the surface of the Earth is now completely covered with water. And we have water stacked up on the poles. So the way the system is being managed is through this process of just, you know, heating up and steaming condensation into the atmosphere, and then it rains down again randomly around the Earth. So you have this new order, this new kind of, you know, this new equator, you know, that you I think maybe Earth might have shifted on its axis a little bit too, you know. That's why I look at the old history, the old ley lines, the old great circle ley lines that were going around the Earth and connecting this ancient empire of the past. We're at a different latitude now than, so it's almost like it rocked. You know what I mean? It's like, as if the Earth's polarity and axis rocked at some time. So I think that that's changed.
Think about this. Let's talk about Matthew 24 briefly. It says, so as in the days of Noah, so will be the, I can't remember how it was. So as in the days of Noah, so will it be
with the
in the coming of the
Son of God.
The Son of Man, yeah.
It's a messianic deal, and where it's saying that it'll be, that you can expect that the world will be like that as it was in the days of Noah.
And what was it? I think it was high technology.
Orbital weapons, all kinds. They're talking about the Russians are trying to put nukes in space. You know, all kinds of shit's going on.
Well, let's briefly, let me run down the pantheon of the Anunnaki.
Okay, hit it. Do you kind of like lay it out? We have to kind of go into a full breakdown of this, but this is our introduction volley where we're trying to bring our audience into to get a closer look at what we've got going on.
Okay, great. According to that paradigm, there are three main characters. There's Anu. He was basically God. He was the leader of the Anunnaki. He didn't hang out on Earth. He hung out in space. He had two sons, one called Enki and one called Enlil. Enlil was the hard ass, and he was the one that, and he had not much compassion for mankind. And I believe he was supposedly part of the flood, part of the reason the flood happened. And Enki, and we can talk a lot about this, because Enki jives with the idea of the serpent in the garden, Pandora's box, any number of knowledge-giving entities. He came to man, told him there was going to be a disaster, and saved many of them. He's attributed, with the serpent in the garden, because the serpent in the garden gives knowledge to man. And no, it was knowledge that we weren't ready for. Man wasn't ready for at the time. So it became a Pandora's box. These myths didn't just sit around and make this crap up. They are going off of previous intelligence and history.
This is the world history that has been veiled in our eyes, in our science books, in our teaching, and our understanding, and it allows for it. If you look at the Bible properly, it allows for this openness in time and space, and these questions to kind of it gives us a remarkable, interesting look in the biblical record, and of course, Luciferians and Satanists rely on these records too, because it describes the movements and their understanding about Satan and these figures. As we understand it in this kind of latest epoch, in this latest age of history, as we understand these figures, in the past, you might have understand Lucifer to be this mover of knowledge across skies. You might have understood him to be Prometheus, the bringer of fire.
Absolutely, Prometheus.
So, right. So this
I should have mentioned that.
No, it's a good point. It's just another history. It's another Greek. It's another foreign culture that has a perception and understanding of history that we need to expand out and understand that the real history of the early Bible describes how there was an incursion of Nephilim activity, as we understand it, or Anunnaki, or other ways of understanding these prehistory creatures and these individuals who were existing and had this relationship with human history. And then they were involved with mankind before the flood and then again after the flood. So there was this incursion after the flood in mankind that apparently David and the Israelites had to deal with, and the Canaanites and the giants of Goliath and his giant brothers. Weren't they supposed to be like 15 feet taller or so? And so,
yeah, and there's Og, whose bed was, I believe his bed was 14 feet large, big. That's what the Bible says.
Yeah, they still we can still find the actual grave, the tomb of Og. It's this huge stone temple structure around temple structure that you can still find. Where is it at? And maybe it's in Lebanon too, even. But
so let's jump back. Okay, let's go back.
I wanted
to
mention one thing too. Another fascinating detail of this discussion is that you know, we know that Freemasons were instrumental in helping to bring about the birth of the Mormon religion and the Book of Mormon. And what something is so interesting about the Mormon, you know, belief system is that they have this idea of humans who were going to occupy foreign planets and other star systems and other galaxies and travel in space far away. You know, that's
right. You become the god of your own planet if you pass the test in Mormonism.
Right.
You ultimately become a god of your own planet.
Right.
I don't want to be a god of my own planet personally, but
it does seem kind of lonely. I mean, I might have it as a possession, but I don't want to just be confined there. There's so much more going on, you know. Like, I just want to keep growing, you know. But no, you carry on. Like I said, this is just the introduction discussion here, and we're just about 40 minutes in. So whenever you want to take a break, we can just you're with the hosts. You're with the hosts of Looking Glass Forum. And we're having another interesting discussion, bringing up the ancient occult history that is now, it's really interesting because it's being revealed, just as the Bible said, that we're getting into this period where knowledge and is advancing at such a hyper velocity that it's incredible.
I know, 200 years, and look where we've gone in 200 years. It's just phenomenal. But let's get back to Genesis 6, because it ties in with the Anunnaki. The sons of God looked down upon the daughters of men and found them to be attractive. And I'm paraphrasing. And they took each one they wanted and made them their wives and had offspring with them. And that's the sons of God and the daughters of man. And these offspring became giants. The Bible is not... They are not wishy-washy in this subject. There were literal giants. Joshua and Caleb said when they went into the land of Canaan, they found that there were beings that we were grasshoppers, size of grasshoppers to them. Exactly. So they were huge.
And these people were in the promised land where they had been directed by Yahweh, their God, to leave out of Egypt and be brought out of slavery and be guided by their God to this new land where he would take them. And there were going to be these individuals in the land, and they were to take the land and get them out, right? And when they arrived, they found that, but not only were the men, the individuals, the beings there, enormous, huge giants, but also they brought back as examples, massive food, right? Massive bundles of grapes, massive examples of giant food. So we're talking about genetically grown and modified super massive food. Am I missing something there? That's what it says.
No, you're right.
Okay.
We just got to reach out one more time, guys, and point to our wonderful sponsor here for Black Incuridian, St. John's Flower Market. Of course, St. John's Flower Market, established in 1993 and 4015 St. John's Avenue in Jacksonville, Florida. You can send beautiful bouquets and flower arrangements to your loved ones anywhere, right? You can just reach out and they have the best prices. And if you go to stjohnsflowermarket.com, stjohnsflowermarket.com, that's St. John's Flower Market, that's abbreviation for stjohnsflowermarket.com, and stjohnsflowermarket.com has just the best prices, the most incredibly beautiful displays and flower arrangements you can possibly imagine. Send gifts of roses, all kinds of wonderful flower arrangements, and various bouquets for different arrangements and different events and weddings and holidays, guys. You have to just check out our wonderful sponsor, St. John's Flower Market, and that's stjohnsflowermarket.com.
So the Anunnaki. Okay, let's talk about what I'm a Christian to the core, and I know you are too. But do you know what a general Christian, and I'm talking Catholic, Protestant, all Christians, how you know what their explanation is for Genesis 6:4, the sons of God?
Tell us.
Okay, the sons of God, this is how they rationalize it. The sons of God are the good sons of Seth, and the daughters of men are the bad daughters of Cain. And I don't know where they get that from.
So they explain that the mystery and the kind of question mark of what the terms actually mean. They explain it by introducing these other biblical figures in a strange way, but they don't address the fact that there seems to be a reference to foreign non-human creatures that are basically coming down from above, right? Am I missing something? They come down from above to the earth. So they're not Terrans. They're not Terrans. They're not earthbound, but they come from above, and they come down to the earth, and they find the women here, the human women, to be handsome.
Right, but are they having sex with them, or are they using in vitro fertilization and genetics? That's the question.
Well, we're talking about
how would you say genetics? How would you say genetics in the Bible? You couldn't. You'd have to say
Genesis.
The sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they created offspring.
Right. But I mean, I think in a Neolithic sense of like Bronze Age kings, you might think about having sex with her, but these guys have spaceships and laser weapons that can bore holes, 9-inch hole diameter holes through granite for a mile down, right? I mean, so they might not need to actually have sex to procreate, right? I mean,
yeah.
Maybe they found women. Maybe they found the women to be a good
fertile
and a good genetic specimen that they could use to genetically elaborate with.
Yeah. Definitely.
That's the question mark. That's where it brings us. It doesn't necessarily need a physical copulation, and it doesn't say that too. It just says that. But at the same time, the offspring were these giants who were apparently roaming the land and had ties to the original legacy of Nimrod, and this original legacy that was a federation of total world empire and total, I guess, United Nations would be the good way to say it.
33rd parallel. Look at all of the monuments on the 33rd or close to the 33rd parallel.
Yep, and
all over the world.
Yeah, if you go around that alignment, we have to sail to them in some zigzag fashion. But if you look with our Google Maps, you can see that they're on this perfect parallel circling the Earth, this perfect ley line. Like we say, it's a great circle alignment that's not possibly accidental. Even the Easter Island heads are on it. And I'm trying to think.
Island, Teotihuacan, Japan, Thailand, India. I believe India.
There's different ley lines. I think there's different great circle parallels too. There's various ones, so you can see that they were building along these things for a great long time. There's no other way to look at it. And through different ages and different cycles of history too, apparently they would pick back up building, especially if you look at the Baalbek in Lebanon, or I think I'm saying that right. The Trilithon stones there, you can see that the Romans came and put massive stones up, huge stones that are like, you know, massive stones as well. And then later on, the Greeks went and built even more stones, and they made it their temple to some god. It's probably meaningful, Athena or something, right?
And I think Apollo. I believe Apollo.
Exactly.
But I want to say one more thing about the Bible and the sons of man. I mean, the sons of God.
Do it.
Nowhere in the Bible does it say the sons of God are the offspring of Seth. Quite the contrary. They say that the sons of God, let's go to Job. Job, I believe in the first chapter, it says Yahweh called the sons of God to court, and Lucifer came. And God asked Lucifer, what are you up to, dude? And he said, he was so cocky. He's like, not much, just going back and forth to earth and walking to and fro upon it. Those are the sons of God are angels. If even though Lucifer was cast out, he was still whatever the dynamic was in heaven. He was allowed to go into heaven and apparently as he pleased.
I mean, and, I guess he would have to.
They were angels. Were angels.
Yeah, he would have to come forward when he was called. And you know, I think that he wasn't, when he was cast down and thrown out, he wasn't destroyed and killed immediately. But I think it's like a court case that plays out in heaven. It's like a long-term process of letting the actual terms of the court play out so that, you know, the final verdict will be found out in the future. And we find ourselves in that historical, you know, breakdown of history in that point. But hey, listen, but we have different things. Like we have that David Flynn thing. We can show the audience these different like points and we can discuss it more. Yeah. And just kind of break it down and take it farther. I think we got got a bunch more to go. So
edit all my ums and uncomfortable pauses out.
Yeah, I will. No, but yeah, so let's just say that we have done a really good job of introducing this now, and we'll just leave the audience with it here. And we have a lot more to go. We want to do a good job of elaborating. What you can find all around the world is these once thought to be separate Neolithic, megalithic structures from time immemorial are now being understood scientifically, and we're piecing together an aspect of Earth's history that goes back before the biblical record and before going back to the ancient city of Atlantis, the Atlantean civilization before of Noah, so to speak. And so we begin to pierce through that mythology and understand the terms of that science more and more.
Well, I would like you to go on YouTube and Google Graham Hancock Göbekli Tepe, because he's the representative for Göbekli Tepe. And he gives you a great rundown on it. Anything you see on it, it's going to be good. So you can't miss.
We'll take the link of that and put it in this episode so you can go down and start your research. And thank you for joining.
When we look at the ancient Sumerian civilization, we attribute them with over 100 of the firsts for a modern society. Things like agriculture, science, medicine, mathematics, kingship, laws, courts, judges, schools, literally all of this shows up in Sumerian times 6,000 years ago, right out of the Stone Age.
According to mainstream researchers, Ur was sacked by their warring neighbors, the Elamites, nearly 2,000 years BC. But some researchers believe the cuneiform texts reveal something much more than evidence of an ancient race. They point to descriptions of a group of divine beings called the Anunnaki, the so-called princely offspring of God, who according to the Sumerians, descended from the sky.
The religious system of Mesopotamia was polytheism, which means that they worshipped hundreds of different gods, both male and female, often depicted in human form, having personalities very much like people do. And these gods were arranged in a kind of political hierarchy that in many ways mimicked the political systems of Mesopotamia itself. And what this means is that you had the high gods, the heavenly gods, and you also had lesser gods who inhabited Earth and the underworld. Now, according to the Sumerian text, the heavenly gods, the Anunnaki, were the supreme deities, the higher deities.
The Anunnaki are among the most mysterious and powerful beings of myth and sacred tradition. The Sumerians describe them as humanoid but non-physical spirit beings who had the capability of morphing or phasing into human form. They came to Earth on a special mission to bring wisdom and also to mine certain materials from the Earth plane itself.
In cuneiform texts, the Anunnaki are described in great detail, including how they lived for hundreds of years. They had tremendous knowledge and power over the entire world. They knew everything. They had knowledge of all of the sciences and arts. Where they got this knowledge and where they came from is a complete mystery to archaeologists. And you have to ask yourself, were they in fact extraterrestrials?
Could the strange gods described in the cuneiform texts really have existed? And if so, might they have been extraterrestrial beings? Ancient astronaut theorists believe the answer is a profound yes. Gale Crater, Mars. August 6th, 2012. The Curiosity lands on the Martian surface to evaluate the suitability of the planet for human exploration. The one-ton rover will find signs of surface water, a key element for sustaining life.
I think one of the very fascinating things from a biology point of view is, let's say Mars, for a period in its history, was similar enough to Earth that life could start to evolve. You could ask the question, how far did it make it? What happened historically on Mars? When did it start to, say, lose an atmosphere? When was it not able to sustain it anymore? And we can learn a lot about the processes on Earth that were successful by, I think, comparing it to how far, if at all, did life get on Mars and where did it fail?
But is it possible, as some ancient astronaut theorists believe, that Curiosity's mission may also reveal evidence that the mysterious beings known as the Anunnaki also once inhabited Mars?
Zachariah Sitchin theorized that the Anunnaki were coming from this planet Nibiru, and that Mars was a way station for them to come from Nibiru to Mars and then to Earth. So you would think that if this is the case, that on Mars we would find some kind of traces of this Anunnaki civilization there. We're going to find pyramids, giant dolmens, huge constructions on Mars, just like we have here on Earth. I suspect we will.
This is the Black Incuridian Transmission.